Welcome to the Washington Updates podcast from the National Association of Health Underwriters. It's been another busy week for health insurance between the start of the ACA's fifth open enrollment period, the release of the 2019 Notice of Benefit and Payment Parameters, and new guidance on the QSE HRAs. On the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, Congress released their initial drafts for tax reform as negotiations continue on market stability and passing a CHIP reauthorization, already more than a month overdue. And Congress and the administration are also in talks to end the cost-sharing lawsuit that has been moving through the courts. Here to break all this down for us are Marcy Buckner, John Green, and Chris Hartman. Welcome. Late last Friday, the Trump administration released the next iteration of the Notice of Benefit and Payment Parameters. What was in this guidance, and what are some major differences between this and those released under the Obama administration?
I think the most notable piece here is that we got a Notice of Benefit and Payment Parameters for 2019. So I think this really signals that the agencies are looking at continuing to move forward and follow the ACA as the law of the land right now while Congress is debating repeal, repair, replace. So I think this is really a large signal coming out from HHS. As far as pieces that are in here, and these are all things that NEHU will comment on, they are looking at ways to make states be able to attain a little bit more flexibility when we're looking at essential health benefits. Instead of being limited to 10 options, states would be allowed to choose from the 50 essential health benefit benchmark plans that other states used for the 2017 plan year. They'd also be able to replace one or more EHB categories of benefits under its EHB benchmark plan used for the 2017 plan year with the same categories of benefits from another state's EHB benchmark plan used for the 2017 plan year, or otherwise select a set of benefits to become its EHB benchmark plan.
And while that sounds really complicated, I actually think this is one of the most interesting pieces to truly allow more uniquely designed assortment of plans out there so that maybe we are not bringing multiple carriers into the market, but I think you're likely to be able to see more types of plans coming from a carrier available in the market with states' flexibility of this type.
And it really allows the states to look at each other and actually be innovative and see what other states are doing and possibly mimic some of what we've seen there. I think the other big pieces that we have here, we already knew about changes that were going to happen in the SHOP program. We were given a heads up there that for 2019, the SHOP was really just going to be used for doing the processing of whether a small business is qualified for a small business tax credit, and that the SHOP enrollment process would be going kind of offline into direct enrollment. So that was also included in here, which again was something that we have expected, but also signals that SSIO and CMS are continuing on with the plans that they've had over the past year going into 2019.
And they did let us know, I think it's because we have a really good open relationship with CMS and work closely with them on the SHOP. But these changes, I think, is going to make it easy for a lot of agents and brokers just to ping and check if they're eligible for the tax credit and then go through that way without having to use the whole platform that they were using before. And that direct enrollment process, I think some of our agents and brokers will like that.
I think it'll be a lot easier to use. Another way they're trying to make things easier here is with the qualified health plan certification standards and allowing states to be more hands-on, specifically those obviously with the state-based exchange, but also those with partnership states and then as well as in the federally facilitated market program. Changes that they're also including for special enrollment periods are proposal to align the enrollment options for all dependents who are newly enrolling in exchange coverage through an SEP and are being added to an application with current enrollees in the program. So that's something new that we have here. Also, changes with rate review. So we're going to go through all of these. And one of the biggest factors that we see here as an opportunity is a section looking at the medical loss ratio. What they're looking at within the notice of benefit and payment parameters specifically is the quality improvement activity reporting requirements within the medical loss ratio. So this isn't necessarily what we've been looking at here at NEHU with trying to adjust the definitions to get agents and brokers a carve out of being included in the administrative fund. But as they are opening up the medical loss ratio here and the notice of benefits and payment parameters, it is an opportunity for us to, in our comments, remind HHS about our continued advocacy and the belief that we have that HHS has the ability through regulations to change the definition and allow agents and brokers to be a carve out from the administrative bucket and try to get some relief there on commissions.
Yeah, this notice on medical loss ratios provides essentially, again, more flexibility to the states, and in this case, flexibility to the states on the medical loss ratio. So I think this does provide us an opportunity not only to remind CMS about agents and brokers being included in medical loss ratio, but an opportunity for us to work with the individual states on agent and broker commissions as part of the medical loss ratio.
The Treasury Department also released guidance on the QSC HRAs in response to the executive order released last month. What changes under this guidance, and what has NHU been hearing from the administration on the executive order?
Earlier this week, we saw guidance on the Qualified Small Employer Health Reimbursement Arrangement. We call
Good
it,
job, Marcy.
Thank you. That's a mouthful. We call it the QSC HRA or the Quasi HRA.
Also heard QRISA, which is
fun. Oh, QRISA. That's interesting. We're going to do Quasi HRA for our purposes today. And what we saw here was a list, really, of different examples and different situations in which the Quasi HRAs could be used. And here, remember, this was something that was passed at the end of last year in the 21st Century Cures Act that allowed for the quasi HRAs, which are an arrangement that meets the following criteria. Their arrangement is funded solely by an eligible employer, and no salary reduction contributions may be made under the arrangement. The arrangement provides, after the eligible employee provides proof of coverage, the payment or reimbursement of medical expenses incurred by the employee or the employee's family members. There's also a cap. The amount of payments and reimbursements for any year does not exceed $4,950 for individual. And the arrangement is generally provided on the same terms to all eligible employees of the eligible employer. And remember, I did say this was for small employers. So that follows the definition that's in the ACA of an employer of having up to 50 employees. When we received this, it is guidance that we have been waiting on since last year. When the 21st Century Cures Act was passed at the end of last year, we had tons of questions pouring in on exactly how these quasi-HRAs could be implemented. And we submitted a long list of questions to the Department of Treasury, many of which are included in the guidance that came out earlier this week. We also met with the Department of Treasury this week, and they did note when we were talking about this guidance that much of it was prompted by the questions that we submitted earlier this year. So it was very nice to hear that not only did they recognize that we had raised these issues, but they were included in the guidance that they provided. The guidance also states that much of this is a response to the executive order directing the Department of Treasury to expand HRAs. And I know we talked about this extensively in a previous podcast talking about the executive order and exactly where this was going to take us on the HRAs. And here, this guidance on the quasi-HRA is part of it. But from our meeting earlier this week, the Department of Treasury is also looking at other avenues for where they can be a little more innovative on HRAs. They're looking at a lot of different options and will be using us as a resource to delve into those. So we will be working with them very closely and possibly reaching out to some of our members for input, just as we had input from members with the questions that we submitted for the quasi-HRAs.
Yeah, I think it's a really good sign, the meeting we had at Treasury this week, that they were interested in hearing from us how they think HRAs are working, who's used the HRAs prior to the guidance coming out, what we think will be happening after the guidance coming out, and what will be going on for the coming year, 2018, 2019. They're really looking towards NHU for guidance around HRAs, how the market's adjusting, but also what guardrails should be put on HRAs so that bad things don't happen.
Right. And I do want to add here, we did have a discussion of, you know, whether our members were picking up on the quasi-HRAs, if they were using them. Part of the issue last year was the 21st Century Cure Act was passed in December, past the 10-1 renewal date. So many small groups had already done the renewals. Some hadn't. And I know some agents were looking in to ways that you could possibly use the quasi-HRA last year, even without the guidance. Now we're getting the guidance in the fall. Still, some small groups, if they have a 12-1 renewal, will have already kind of picked out their plan, but there is the possibility that this will help increase that some of the numbers of folks that are doing the quasi-HRA. However, the other concern here is these are folks that are now going into the individual market if they're going through the quasi-HRA, and whether they want to be in the individual market, which is obviously a bit more in upheaval than the small and large group markets. So whether employers want to kind of roll the dice and have their employees going into the individual market, or if they'd rather continue offering small group coverage.
Moving on to tax reform, we now have more concrete details on how congressional Republicans envision tax reform. NHU has been chiefly concerned with the employer exclusion of health insurance. Is it safe in this release? And does NHU envision any changes to employer-based insurance under tax reform?
Well, certainly anything could happen, right? They've dropped a bill today. The issues that were foremost on our watch list, namely the employer exclusion, is not in there.
And I think everybody deserves quite a bit of credit for the efforts that our agents and brokers have been doing through Operation Shouts and others to remind members of Congress the negativity of any even capping the employer exclusion. So a big congratulations to NHU members for their efforts on that.
That's a really good point, Chris, because oftentimes when we send out the Operation Shouts, if it's something like an educational piece like these with the employer exclusion, reminding members of Congress the importance of preserving it, if it doesn't have a bill number on it, or if it's not something that's moving right that moment, sometimes we have questions from members about how valuable that shout is. And here it's very valuable because even though there wasn't a bill number attached to it, we knew they were working on tax reform. So those shouts helped to make sure that that wasn't included in this bill.
This is a really big win.
So far, true to his word, the speaker said that he would parking health care into a parking lot and tax reform would stay largely tax reform. Now, there is a provision, Chris, that does touch health care.
So there's a couple of pieces in health care that are in the bill, but I would say, again, to double down on that, there's no change to the employer exclusion. This has been NHU's number one priority, and one of the concerns we've had with certain members of the Republican leadership who believe in either eliminating the employer exclusion. So we're really pleased that us and our allies were able to push back and stop it from getting in the bill. Doesn't mean it couldn't show up later down the road through amendments or in the Senate bill or other places, but for now, this is a huge success. A couple of other things on healthcare. We saw some tweets and other conversations about possibly eliminating the individual mandate in the bill. There is no elimination to the individual mandate. So again, the pieces of the ACA are not being changed by this bill. Even if we've seen tweets to the subject that might be affected the individual mandate. So again, the ACA is not changed and nothing's changing for open enrollment. And everybody, the individual mandate is still there. And you need to tell your clients it's still there. But the legislation does change a couple of areas of healthcare. One being the itemized deduction for medical expenses. There's a repeal for that. So if this would be a particular damage to somebody who has significant healthcare costs, if you have significant healthcare costs that are outside of what you have covered by insurance, the ability to deduct that has been significant for some households, and I think will have a negative effect. Also, there's no ability to deduct any more contributions to the Archer medical savings accounts. I know some of our members have set up Archer medical savings accounts for individuals and businesses and others. There's no ability to deduct that anymore. So the savings, Archer medical savings accounts will still be there, but without the deductibility, they would be less attractive. And there are a couple of other changes to healthcare about tax credit to drug makers and clinical testings and others, but those are a little less directly related to what our members deal with.
So they plan to go move fairly quickly to a markup, at which time members will be able to offer amendments. So this is still going to go through, you know, a deliberative process, and changes can be expected as they move through the committee process. But I think once it gets through committee, they'll probably do some kind of closed rule and get it out of the House.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're using, again, the reconciliation process. And I think that this bill has a good chance of moving forward, probably with a couple of adjustments passing the House. When it goes over to the Senate, I think that's a different story. Chairman Hatch, who's exceedingly interested in tax reform, will put his own imprint on the tax bill over there and the reconciliation process there. I think what comes about in the Senate won't necessarily look like this bill, but I do think overall momentum is there for tax reform, and doing something in that category, I think, will have a big impact. The one thing I would say about this House bill, that, and one of the reasons I think Hatch will look at it very differently when it gets over there, is there aren't a lot of quote-unquote pay-fors in this tax bill and things that offset it. There are some changes to the mortgage deduction out there for homes over $500,000 that you buy in the future, and some related to state and local taxes. There aren't that many pay-fors. And when this gets scored, it's most likely that it's going to score as increasing the deficit. Even if CBO uses dynamic scoring to show economic growth, this might still score increasing the deficit. That's fine for the House, and it can easily pass that way with that. But in the Senate, under the Berg rule, it's going to have to score savings. So again, I think that's why Hatch is going to make some adjustments when the bill gets over there. When the bill gets over there, we don't want those savings, again, to be that employer exclusion. So it is not time to let foot off the gas when it comes to the employer exclusion. If people are looking for money, they may come back looking towards the health insurance universe for sorts of funds. And we need to be there to say, this is not the right area to get involved with as this process continues on.
And not only is the political dynamic different, but particularly with regard to the state and local tax deductibility, you know, they've capped it in the House, but I could see Hatch saying, well, we don't have any members that this really affects, and so we're going to dig deeper into that. So it'll be an interesting process to watch. President Trump's already come out and said that he plans this to be the big Christmas present for the American taxpayer.
Congressional Republicans and the Trump administration said this week that they are seeking to wind down the lawsuit over the cost-sharing subsidies. Does this mean the end of the legal challenges? And what does it mean for market stability legislation? Can CHIPS still be a vehicle for stability legislation?
You all know that this is one of my favorite topics to talk about, and just the fascination on a policy level of the intricacies here with the cost-sharing reduction payments and the challenges in the court and the dynamics between the three branches of government here. If the Trump administration decides not to continue with its lawsuit that it's being sued by the House that they inherited from the Obama administration, there is still a chance that this lawsuit would go forward, because this summer the Democrat attorneys general were granted standing to intervene in the case. So even if the Trump administration decides not to go forward with that appeal, the Democrat attorneys general will be able to do that without action from the Trump administration. So there is a chance that this could continue forward. However, I think with the dynamic we're seeing now, moving into open enrollment and having these plans set, there's not going to be a way to turn back the clock on that quite yet, unless there's an active Congress. So I think as we move into 2018 and 19, if there still hasn't been any action by Congress, there is going to be action by the Democrat attorneys general. Possibly, I would give it 6 to 8 months. The courts have continued to give stays, which are kind of like a pause in the system for the different parties to determine their steps moving forward. So I would not be surprised if the courts gave another stay and gave a few more months for the parties to determine what to do. During that time, it will be very crucial to look over to Congress to see if any of the market stability bills are moving forward. I think this week, Hatch and Brady both had bills that were formally introduced. I think we talked about them last week or the week before. This week, they were formally introduced with bill numbers. Both continue the cost-sharing reduction payments through 2019, and then couple it with an employer and individual mandate, not repeal, but zeroing out of the penalties. So it's going to be interesting to watch. However, the Hatch-Brady bill is seen as a Republican bill, sidelined by the Alexander Murray bipartisan bill that also continues to fund the cost-sharing reduction payments, but then couples that with 1332 waiver state flexibility, which I know we've also talked about in depth. So do I think this is the end of the lawsuits? Definitely not. Do I think this is the end of market stability in Congress? I'm going to say no to that as well.
Yeah, I think there's growing appetite to do something at the end of the year, particularly if they do get tax reform done. The euphoria over that will just maybe spill over. But there's a recognition, and I think that Hatch's release of a bill today on CSR payments is a pretty significant move given the tension that's existed between the two chairmen.
Going back to Dan's question about can CHIP still be a vehicle for this legislation, I would have thought CHIP would have passed into law by now, period.
We I agree.
Are talking about the program has expired, out of funds. On the bright side, several states still have quite a bit of funds to keep program running, but we're kind of way past the deadline, over 30 days now, way past where CHIP has ever gone before. Luckily, CMS has started issuing funds for some states that are running out of money, even without the legal authority to issue those funds. But they can only play these games of patching the hole for so long at CMS before they start running out of funds to be able to transfer in. So I would have thought CHIP would be done by now. Now, the House is expected on a partisan basis to pass the bill. There's some disagreements over the offsets. But the Senate's still waiting here. And so if CHIP's going to be the vehicle for market stability, I'm not so sure about this. I think CHIP might need a vehicle to send in a log now because of how difficult it's been moving on its own. So it might need to be included in some larger package moving through Congress because it hasn't had that sort of momentum, even with bipartisan support of the program that we've seen in the past.
Well, you may recall that the Senate punted to the House on the how they were going to pay for all of this, and the House accepted the policies, the structure of the Senate bill, and left it up to the House to duke it out. And they have been duking it out for many, many weeks and have frankly not been able to come to some sort of agreement. And so now it's, you know, coming home to roost as to what the pay-fors are, and Democrats remain unhappy about what those cuts are because it includes some cuts to ACA programs. So anyway, they have the votes to do it. They're going to move forward without them and now give it back to the Senate. And guess what? Now the Senate's all interested in what the pay-fors are, and they have a different idea of what the pay-fors are going to be. So who knows how much longer this is going to go on.
Well, I agree there's definitely a disagreement over what the pay-fors should be, how you pay for it. At the same time, we have children who are going to be disenrolled in the coming year from health insurance. And a lot of states have to start deciding how to wind down that process soon, because you can't just the next day say you're without insurance. You've got to give people some sort of notice so they can find other areas of health care. One of those other areas of health care would be open enrollment, but states aren't sending out those notices yet. So we need a resolution to this problem because there are real people involved in this program at the end of the line, and there are real lives that matter here.
So the House is going to consider on Friday. We know that this is an issue that Senator Hatch, Chairman Hatch, has been closely aligned with from its inception and is dear to his heart. And I think that it should come to some resolution, hopefully fairly quickly, particularly with tax reform on its heels.
Finally, this week marks the beginning of open enrollment. What has changed for agents and brokers this year, and what should consumers expect?
So this year, we do have a few things that are different. One is the large cut to outreach programs, enabling folks to be aware that open enrollment is happening, even though, as Dan mentioned at the top of the podcast, that this is the fifth open enrollment period. It is still a new process to many folks, and the dates have changed over the years. So it's not like the April 15 tax deadline that everyone is familiar with. It's something that has a changing target here. So of course, open enrollment is November 1st through December 15th. Something new with outreach.
The federal exchange.
Excuse me. Yes. Thank you, Chris. In the federal exchange, state exchanges are able to have different dates, and many do. Many have extended it. So it is important to point out that those dates are just for the federal exchanges. One thing that is different in the FFM for agents and brokers is a new, what they're calling help on demand feature for agents and brokers and consumers specifically. So this is something new consumers can expect. And it is something that will pop up if the consumer is on healthcare.gov, a little box that will pop up, a chat box asking if they need more assistance and if they would like to be contacted. They will then put in their information and say, yes, they want to be contacted. And it will contact an agent or broker in the area who has self-selected that they want to participate in this program. And I think with the piloting of the program, folks were getting calls within 10 or 15 minutes to be able to respond to these consumers. So we're really excited about this.
This is really good for agents and brokers because, you know, they could have set up this program in such a way that the call centers would be calling out if you wanted more help. Instead, they're actually using agents and brokers as the number one resource for signing people up onto this program. And it's not some government contract that's handling this. It's going to be agents and brokers who actively engage in the individual market.
Right. This is something that is just for agents and brokers. It doesn't expand to navigators or the call center, none of that. So we are very excited to be seeing this. I think it's a great step forward for agents and brokers and a way to really show even more our value. I know year after year, agents and brokers are the leading group with enrollments in the federal marketplace. And so with this option now, I think we're able to prove our worth even more, which helps us to get something new every year. I don't know if you all have noticed, but there have been improvements every year as we've gone along with access for agents and brokers, this being one of them. So as we're moving along, that's one of the pieces that we'll be using to try to broker even more response for agents and brokers going down the line.
Even if you look at the website this year, the prominence of using an agent or broker is much more upfront, no scrolling down, much more easy to get to an agent broker quickly. Not that you have to first dig through, no, I don't actually want to use a navigator. I'd actually prefer to use a broker. Like there's not that same sort of, I'm affirmatively having to go off and look for a broker. We're upfront and prominent. Often the first item that will pop up for people when they're looking for healthcare. So the website continues to improve for agents and brokers.
And other pieces as far as what to expect, much of this has been pushed out from CMS and CSIO. They are doing healthcare maintenance every Sunday from 12 a.m. to 12 p.m. So those are going to be times where you won't be able to access the system, but hopefully these aren't times of heavy business for you all. And they are, even with the reduced funding for outreach, still trying to do some outreach campaigns. Many of them are going to be very low cost. So things like email, text messaging, and auto dial messages. I know I'm not a big fan of auto dial messages myself, but just kind of pointing these things out in case your clients are contacted in this way, that it is something that the government is doing. But of course, always be very vigilant with them, making sure that they're not being contacted by fraudulent entities. But those are some of the ways that they will be trying to contact folks, as well as different email programs.
And to kind of wrap up our podcast for today, we'd like to do a little Medicare moment. So Chris and I work on a whole host of issues as you hear every week, and that includes Medicare. And we're very pleased to announce that Mr. Corbello from Florida has agreed to be our champion on the COBRA bill. And so we're just trying to wrap up the other co-sponsors for the bill. So if you're on COBRA and miss your 63-day window to sign up for Part B and Medicare, you could be subjected to a 10% penalty for life. And so, the intersection between employer-sponsored coverage and Medicare is becoming increasingly complex because people stay in employment much longer than they did in 1965 when this was created. You got your gold watch at 65 and went off into the sunset. But people have come back into the workforce because of perhaps hits they took during the recession on their retirement accounts and are basically forced to come back. And so it's a much more complicated life we lead today. So just to sort of get at this issue of the penalty and make things right for seniors who thought that they were doing the right thing by having COBRA, we're introducing this legislation soon, we hope, and we're just wrapping up who will all be on the initial bill when it comes out.
Our thanks to Marcy Buckner, John Green, and Chris Harbin for joining us in this week's podcast for the Washington Update from the National Association of Health Underwriters. Thank you for listening.